You're listening to a podcast from Blogging Heads TV.
Hello, Bill.
Good morning, Matt.
It's good to see you, Bill. We normally don't see each other, but now we're using a different recording method, and it's good to see you. And I like the books behind you. They look pretty cool. Meet Calvin Coolidge.
Meet Calvin Coolidge, the man behind the myth. I have a quite extensive Coolidge collection. I have this little pamphlet from the farm to the White House. I have some of his own books. This is the autobiography, which covers that. Very interesting. Coolidge, Wit and Wisdom, 125 short stories about Cal.
It is great that you're a huge Calvin Coolidge fan.
Whenever you want to visit, Matt, and check out my library, the unique inauguration of Calvin Coolidge, America's 30th president.
Is that Dutch? Is that Dutch I see behind you?
What's
the
that?
Edmund Morris book?
Oh, yeah. This is the controversial Reagan biography, Dutch. What you also might not know is this photo on the cover is a Pete Souza. Pete Souza, who was Obama's White House photographer.
Oh, wow.
He was also Reagan's White House photographer. And Edward Morris said that was just the perfect Reagan shot. You know, the legs crossed in perfect Hollywood stride, the optimistic hand in the air.
That's a good picture. Yeah, he looks pretty cool.
Obviously.
I would expect nothing less from Renatus Magnus. But he looks amazing as always. So I'm sure you have hundreds of books. Are these some of your favorite, like, sort of presidential history books back there?
I've not read
that you've put on display.
I've not read them all. I'm trying to get there. I have read Dutch. I haven't read all of my Coolidge books. I did read Puritan in Babylon, William Allen White. This is mostly just to remind myself, because if you go up the shelves, these are all my president books. Remind myself that I need to read all these. It's in my face in my living room every day. You have not read all of these things. Get on it.
Well, I think we should do a segment where you go through, like, before we were taping, you were telling, you have like a McKinley book, a book about the assassination of McKinley.
Yeah,
is that
this
right?
This was published.
It'd be a rough day when that whole thing comes crashing down on you because I asked you to get a book.
This was published the year of the assassination, Life of William McKinley and Complete Story of His Assassination. I mean, this is a fairly traumatic thing for a president to be shot and murdered. And it was a political assassination by a left-wing anarchist. And, you know, it's sort of treated like this sort of, you know, obscure historical footnote. But it literally killed a fairly conservative president and replaced him with one of the most liberal presidents, Teddy Roosevelt. I don't think his assassin was a Teddy Roosevelt fan. He was, you know, he was an anarchist. You had a major ideological shift in the country from a murder.
And think about how crazy things are today, how insane things are today. And we tend to think that, like, well, things used to be normal, but now things are crazy. Well, an anarchist, a leftist anarchist assassinated the president. And I mean, that's some weird stuff that used to happen back in the day. And so we have to keep that in perspective when we consider how crazy things seem right now, I think. By the way, let me also mention, as I drinking out of my cup, which I'm not sure why it has Darth Vader and Orioles. Like, someone gave me these cool cups. You know Christy, our friend Christy Spates, who helped edit my book and is a good friend. But anyway, the baseball season started, so a toast. The Orioles are now first place in the American League East, having won their first game against the hated Toronto Blue Jays.
this is big. Big baseball news here in New England. It is the opening season for the Hartford Yard Goats.
That's a cool name.
So this 2 years ago, they were the New Britain Rock Cats. They relocated to Hartford last year, but there was a problem. There was some political wrangling with the new stadium. The stadium wasn't built on time, and a contractor got fired, and things got slowed down. So last year, the Yard Goats, in their inaugural year as the Yard Goats, did the entire season on the road.
That's tough.
And so this year is the first year. Actually, opening day is in 2 weeks for them.
Oh, cool.
So I've not bought my tickets yet, but I'm hoping to get a Yard Goats game in before the year is out.
Well, no, you should go to. I mean, there's nothing better than minor league baseball. It's fun. It's good for the family. Prices aren't ridiculous. So that's cool. I like that.
I'm a little annoyed. I mean, the Hartford Stadium is actually easier for me to get to. It's right downtown. It's off of the highway. But they really screwed New Britain. New Britain is not a big town. Their team was sort of the pride of the town. Now they have a giant stadium with nothing to do, with nothing to put in it. And this is all just to have corporate skyboxes for insurance industry executives in Hartford. Yeah. So there's a bit of a bitter aftertaste to it all, but nevertheless, yeah, it's still going to go.
They say that, you know, there have been all these studies that say that that stadiums don't really impact the town and all that, and that, you know, that maybe even have a negative financial impact. But I think that they can. We're seeing it happen in Washington, D.C., where the Nats play. That I was just over to that area, sort of the Navy Yard area, which is really turning into something quite nice. And also just the psychology of, I mean, I remember when the Redskins used to play in Washington, D.C. at RFK Stadium, and they were winning, you know, Super Bowls every other year. There is a certain esprit de corps that a whole city can get, you know. So I think there are some, you know, intangible benefits to having teams to support. We don't, you know, nowadays, you know, tribalism, you know, and for some pretty good reasons is unfashionable but the one thing that you can do is sort of root for your team. And I think it matters.
Well, I'm not an expert on Hartford, urban policy or anything. And I know the studies that show stadiums generally are, you know, just they're not a growth maker. They just, you know, move money around and aren't worth, you know, giant subsidies. But I can tell you, Hartford is pretty dead at night for a city that actually has a fair amount of wealth with the insurance industry, yet it's got no real discernible nightlife. I have to think that plopping a stadium right in the middle is going to do something. I mean, it's going to be some activity that's going to be around that and make it a more appealing place to go at night. But the proof of the pudding is in the eating, as they say.
Yeah, no, and it may be or just during games. I mean, I was in St. Louis for for one of the debates, and that area, the stadium is really a nice area. But it's dead when there's not a game there. Like, I went over and looked at the stadium, and there were, like, plenty of bars and restaurants around that area, but it was a ghost town. And I'm talking about a beautiful, you know, like, afternoon, Saturday afternoon, but it's people go to there to go to work, and then they come home, and nobody lives there. Anyway.
You need to have kind of 24/7 urban strategy. You can't assume that the stadium does it all. You got to add to that so that there's enough reason.
Man,
to be
I tell
there.
You what, in a different life, I'm going to become a city planner or something. I don't know that much
Matt
about
Lewis,
it.
You are a betrayal to the conservative cause.
Well, see, I do. I think that, you know, walkable communities, we've been through this before, the crunchy cons thing, you know, walkable communities. And I think, look, if local governments take it upon themselves to try to create areas and that are, you know, conducive to the human spirit and to thriving, that's a good thing.
Good thing we have a builder in the White House, so I'm sure has a very sensitive and caring approach to walkable, livable urban living.
Yeah, I'm sure that's on the top of his list. Well, anyway, we got a lot. We did a little pre-gaming. There's a lot of topics we could talk about, but what should we talk about today?
I think we should get Gorsuch out of the way. I know we've talked about Gorsuch a lot.
Yeah.
But the motion for cloture has been filed. Presumably Gorsuch will be filibustered on Thursday, and then McConnell will move to eliminate the filibuster for Supreme Court nominees. I think that vote would occur on Friday then. And the question, I'm a little surprised that there is no Republican appetite for stopping the rules change. I might have thought someone would pipe up. Maybe you would need three to break ranks, and I wasn't assuming they would get three. You know, maybe Susan Collins, you know, at least gives it a shot. Maybe John McCain, he was in the Gang of 14 before. He just won his election. He's over 80 years old. He doesn't owe anybody anything. He cares about the legacy of the Senate. Maybe he would do some last-minute talks. And they both have sort of said, yeah, I'm not happy about this, and I've reached out a little bit, but there's no hope here. So I don't know. Do you have a twinge of concern that we are losing the distinct nature of the Senate if it's just sort of a similar body to the House that the vision of the founders and the Senate being the cooling saucer, all that stuff is lost forever?
Well, I have, you know, I have deep concerns about the state of our politics today, but this one in particular doesn't strike me as more concerning than a lot of other things that I'm seeing happen right now. And so it doesn't, you know, I'm not up in arms about this. I think, you know, part of it is just the context. There's the fact that, you know, Harry Reid already eliminated the filibuster for other executive appointments and judicial appointments other than the Supreme Court. So he sort of greased the skids here for a sort of predictable slippery slope. You have the fact that Gorsuch is really a highly competent, qualified, you know, nominee. And I think you have the fact that he's just replacing Scalia. He's simply, you know, it's not going to change the balance of the court. So for all those reasons, it just strikes me as, I guess it would be, I think Democrats are breaking norms here. Not to say that Republicans have been as well, but I think Democrats are breaking norms. If you can't confirm Neil Gorsuch, then who can you confirm? And if Democrats are going to filibuster Neil Gorsuch, who wouldn't they filibuster? So I think he's a nominee within the mainstream. And so I think it takes two to tango. This is going to happen. And the good news is that I don't think the slope is as slippery. So when in 2013, when Harry Reid, you know, basically eliminates the filibuster for other appointments, it's a very obvious next step to get rid of this, you know, filibustering Supreme Court nominees. I think luckily there's a little bit of a firewall here before we get around to eliminating the filibuster for legislative, you know, for legislation.
Now, McConnell said yesterday that he would not eliminate for legislation. He would commit to that not happening on his watch as majority leader.
He said that he doesn't think there's a single member of the U.S. Senate that would want to get rid of the filibuster for legislation.
But what happens if there is a prized conservative policy goal and it is clearly running up against the wall of a filibuster? I mean, look, part of the reason why healthcare has gotten complicated and tax reform has gotten complicated is that they're trying to thread the needle with budget reconciliation, which is the one way to do legislation without it being filibustered, which is creating awkward policy compromises to fit the parameters of reconciliation, which is making it hard for Republicans to be unified. So at some point, they're going to have to try to pass something without reconciliation. It will likely be filibustered. Someone in the conservative movement is going to say, you have no obligation to keep this. You know you can eliminate the filibuster. This is important to your base. It's important to your legacy. It's time to nuke it. Isn't that pressure going to build?
Oh, I think it definitely could, but I think it would take time. Remember, we got to where we are now over the course of decades of people. You know, this is how norms are broken. And how things that are taboo become acceptable. You know, it takes time. And I think that it took decades, or at least a decade, of people saying we should get rid of the filibuster for Supreme Court were threatening the nuclear option before we got to where we are. And I think likewise, it's entirely possible that someday we'll get rid of the filibuster for everything, for legislation. I hope that day doesn't come, but I think it could come. And we may look back and this and say that what happened here is a step in that direction. I still think we're a long way off from that. But of course, there's nothing in the Constitution that says these are Senate rules, longstanding Senate rules. Did you know that I went back and researched this. Aaron Burr was somehow responsible for the filibuster. You know about this?
I don't know about this.
Oh, man, I wish I was more prepared to tell you this. If I was Bill Scheer, I would really drop some knowledge on you. It was after he killed Hamilton. Mm-hmm. I guess he was presiding over the Senate.
Right, he's still vice president.
So, and he did it totally inadvertently. Now the filibuster actually has a long history that goes back to Rome. Back in Rome, a filibuster, they had to do legislate, it had to happen within one day. And so if one senator stood up and just talked until sunset, that effectively killed a bill. But America did not have this, it's not in the Constitution. And basically, I forget how it was. I wish I was more prepared, but just Google filibuster Aaron Burr. And he inadvertently suggested a rule change that opened the door for people being able to filibuster. He thought he was expediting things, saving time. And it actually took years before people figured out that he had created this loophole and began exploiting it. But even then, filibustering was a very rare occurrence. It didn't happen often, like a couple times a year or something. The problem now, of course, is it's become pervasive. You no longer have to stand up and actually filibuster. You don't have to do the gym, Mr. Smith goes to Washington sort of thing. So that might be one area too where you could do filibuster reform, actually making people stand up, and you can't go to the bathroom, you can't take a break, you can't pass it to Rand Paul and let, right. You've got to be the one doing
right.
it.
I mean, and Democrats have proposed that sort of filibuster reform before and couldn't get anywhere with it. This is when, Republicans were filibustering everything in the Obama years. And, now, at least at the moment, Republicans have a different problem. They're not even getting to the point where Democrats can filibuster. They can't get their own caucus in line. And we're now seeing them go back to health care, trying to cobble together a majority in the House. You're starting to see fissures emerge over tax reform. As you look at this, Matt, and as other conservatives in Washington look at this, is there consternation that Trump and Ryan are frittering away the majority, this moment of single party rule that they have?
Well, I think there's a fear that could happen because, it's very possible that Republicans will lose the House of Representatives in the midterms. And if that happens, that obviously changes things. You could have then Trump really make a full-throated attempt to work with Democrats. And that if you're a conservative, that really changes the kind of legislation that might come out. I am interested by this attempt to resurrect the health care bill. Right after the Republican plan, Republican bill was pulled, Paul Ryan went out in front of the microphones and cameras and said, "Obamacare is the law of the land and will be in the near future." And now it does seem like there's an attempt to pass something at least through the House. It seems like they're making progress. Now, will the Senate pass it? Will they change it? What does it look like when it comes out of conference committee? I mean, this is still, even if they could pull off what now seems like pulling a rabbit out of their hat, passing something through the House, that would only be the beginning of the process. But I think that part of the reason Republicans were in a hurry, too big of a hurry, in fact, and tried to push that health care bill so quickly is because they realized that time is not on their side. Now, the fact that they're taking a 2-week recess, Easter recess, doesn't help things.
The government on the verge of shutting down as soon as they get back.
Right. So you might wonder, like, why they're taking 2 weeks off. But be that as it may, I don't think we're in the panic mode yet, but I do think that there is concern that they're going to fritter this away. The one thing I would say is I think that I see a huge dichotomy here between Trump's legislative opportunities, which look very problematic, and the things that that he's sort of quietly done, that his administration's quietly done. You know, this thing, the Congressional Review Act, the CRA. This is a bill that was passed by the Republican revolutionaries in 1994. David McIntosh, who heads the Club for Growth, actually sponsored this bill. And it had only been used one time in like 25 years or whatever. And now Republicans have used it. This is interesting, Bill. It's for regulations that were newly enacted. There's actually a timeline on it. And Republicans have actually repealed several Obama, sort of late, last-minute Obama regulations. You've obviously got Neil Gorsuch, who, you know, will likely be confirmed at the Supreme Court on Friday. So this is a guy who could serve for 30 or 40 years. And not only is he likely to be, you know, what you might think of as a conservative justice, but when it comes to regulations, he has been against this thing called Chevron deference, which basically says that you should, that judges should defer to bureaucrats and governmental agencies when they make rules without, you know, any congressional oversight.
When laws are vague.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. So the point here is that on one hand, Donald Trump looks to be really losing. He's embroiled in scandal constantly. He's got some major legislative challenges, you know, between fighting off the Freedom Caucus on one hand, the Tuesday group on the other, and then Democrats who are basically, you know, not irrationally, I think, in fact, very rationally, decided to be obstructionist. But simultaneously, and I think under the radar, he's setting up some long-term things in motion and regulatory changes that I think are probably underappreciated. And I think if you're a liberal, you should be like probably more worried about these things. And if you're a conservative, you should probably be a little bit more happy about some of the things that's happening in terms of judges and regulatory rollback.
Well, the regulatory rollback that's happening so far are mainly things that were done by Obama at the very end. Those are the things that you could easily undo without the filibuster through the Congressional Review Act. And so liberals are not happy about that stuff. But there are a whole bunch of other things.
Executive orders like the Clean Coal Plan. The Clean Power Plan,
they can't undo that way because that wasn't as recent. So the executive order there is to go work on undoing it, but it's not actually undone yet.
And there'll be litigation. Well, exactly. I mean, so surrounding that,
there, you know, like with Clean Power Plan, Dodd-Frank, healthcare, the bigger what's that?
The other one, Waters of the USA, or Waters.
These bigger ones have a difficult legal path to pursue, and we have no evidence that the Trump administration knows how to do the hard stuff. They're picking off what low hanging fruit is out there, but they certainly can't seem to pass a major bill. And even you have conservatives that are mad at Pruitt. I mean, this is one of the chief antagonists to the EPA through his whole life. This is not a squish. But you know, there's a key piece in the climate regulation foundation called the endangerment finding, where the EPA says we find that greenhouse gases cause climate change, and therefore we have a legal obligation to regulate them. The right wants Pruitt to erase that finding, so there is no legal obligation to do anything on climate. And Pruitt's like, eh, you know, that's not as easy as it sounds. There's a whole. Look, I'm actually a lawyer. I actually sue the EPA. I actually know what's involved here. That's a really long path.
And I should probably say that my wife, Erin, used to consult for him when he was attorney general.
All right, so
I'll put that out there. Not that it matters. Not that it impacts what I want to say. By the way,
just to finish the point. So, so you have people saying Pruitt is not being conservative enough on climate, because in all likelihood he's going to leave that finding in place, which gives environmentalists legal recourse to say, hey, these other things that you're trying to do are in violation of your obligations under the endangerment finding. I mean, so Pruitt doesn't have a perfect path to pursue. I think he's making a logical choice. Like, this is the best path I have. But it just shows that there's a lot of hurdles in front of them. And Trump hasn't pocketed all that much in these first 100 days. So I got to think some people on the right have to be saying to themselves, did they sequence this properly? Did it make sense to do healthcare first? Should they have done taxes first? Should they have done something else completely? Should they just focus on deregulations and not these more thorny questions? I mean, for all the knocking of Obama as some sort of dilettante, I mean, he got the Recovery Act passed in a month. That was a pretty major piece of legislation. So Mr. Art of the Deal seems to be falling short on the promise that it would be so easy to get all this stuff done.
No, that definitely is true. A couple quick points also about the regulations. One is there's an interesting provision in the Congressional Review Act that says once a regulation is repealed via CRA, it can never be re-implemented again by a future president. So I've heard a somewhat clever idea that Republicans, or, you know, that right now, Republican bureaucrats or a Republican administration should go ahead and implement some of the if I was a liberal, what would I want to do in terms of regulation? Go ahead and do it, and then have it repealed by Congress.
And you could never do it again.
And therefore, you could never do it again.
I suppose unless Congress passed a law.
Yeah.
Right.
I mean, you could always, there's always a way around it. The other thing too is, I don't know where this is. Maybe you do, Bill, the RAINS Act. There's a thing called the RAINS Act, which it's like the CRA, except it's proactive instead of reactive. It basically would say that, you know, the Constitution says that Congress is supposed to write the law, not the executive branch or their governmental agencies. And so it would basically reassert the power of regulations, and Congress would have to basically have approval of rules and regulations.
Right. It would greatly, grind the gears of government. Right now, Congress passes a law with a lot of latitude, and the agencies use that latitude to say, well, here's specifically what we're going to do to implement this. The RAINS Act basically says you got to come back to us every single time. Every little regulation you do, it's got to really be, scrubbed by us. But your point about the CRA and that notion that once you yank the rule back, the regulators can't redo it. There's at least one out there. I think it was a bank one, if I remember correctly, that Lindsey Graham was like, I don't want to CRA this. I do want this to be regulated. I don't like this particular rule, but I don't want to make it impossible for them to go back and do it again. So there's some breaks on the system. This is why ACA repeal didn't happen. Even some people on the left thought, oh, one party rule means they're going to get everything that they want. But there's division between the party that even makes some of these things they're supposed to make conservative governing easier still complicated.
But I have to say, I'm relieved by the failure of the AHCA, partly because it wasn't a good bill and it wasn't a conservative bill, and it would have, I think, hurt Republicans and conservatives. But also, it reassured me a little bit that Donald Trump can't do whatever he wants. You know, I'm a little bit worried about politicians with authoritarian tendencies, and Trump had just rolled over everybody and imposed his will for a couple of years. And the fact that Congress checked him and said no, and he had to abide by that, I took as a very reassuring thing, that a little bit of a return to normalcy. You know, sometimes one man's gridlock is another man's, you know, balance of power and democracy. So,
well, this sort of brings back a question that we've come back to this a number of times, but I think it's worth always checking in. So he's down in the 30s in Gallup, and so he was in the upper 30s in Gallup. He was at 35 in Quinnipiac. A Quinnipiac poll that I saw had him underwater with whites, had him at 47 with white men, and at 51 with white non-college. And white non-college, I think on election day, was 66. So, you know, some evidence that there is base erosion, that it's not just the divide that we saw on election day manifesting all over again. Even within Trumpian areas, there's a pullback. And so you see the relevance of that. Republicans in Congress are not afraid to stand up to Trump. They say, I can oppose him, and I'm not going to pay for it at home. And when so Trump goes out there and says, we have to fight the Freedom Caucus. I mean, basically suggesting he's going to actively primary Freedom Caucus people. I saw
active measures.
I saw Mark Meadows, who's the chair of the Freedom Caucus. He was asked, "Are your favorite primary challenge?" And Meadows was like, "You can't get to the right of me in my district. That's not possible." So the intimidation factor is not there. Maybe he's Reaganing, but he's not Johnsoning. He's not scaring the hell out of these folks. So do you think is Trump going to follow through here and actually do the primary challenges, or is this just more, you know, I'm cranky in the morning when I get up and tweet?
Well, I hope he doesn't. I think it would be stupid for him to try to do that. You know, don't get mad, don't get even, get ahead. And so I think that right now these guys are not afraid of him. Now maybe they could be afraid of him if he expended all sorts of time and energy and capital in trying to defeat Republicans in the primaries. Maybe he could teach them a lesson, and maybe a year from now or even 6 months from now, they might be intimidated and back down and vote with him. I just feel like that's a lot of energy and effort to possibly change somebody. And maybe it wouldn't work. Maybe it would backfire. Maybe these guys would be like, you know, look, I'm here on principle. You're not going to be able to take me down. So there's a chance it would work, but it would take a lot of time and energy and effort. And at the end of the day, you're probably weakening your own party in the midterms. It's going to give you bad press. Most of the time, I think revenge is a bad idea, and not only because as a human being, it's not, you know, where you want to be in terms of spiritual matters, but just I think people expend a ton of time and energy trying to get even with people when they really should be working to get ahead. So he may do it, you know, it would be in keeping with his ML, but I think it's a mistake.
FDR tried this. I think we've talked about it in a past show. FDR tried to purge conservative Democrats in 1938. He actively endorsed primary challenges. They mostly failed. It was hugely embarrassing, and it drove those conservative Democrats even farther into Republican arms, where he couldn't get any more New Deal reforms passed. Now, you could argue that the conservatives were already bedeviling him and his party. Roosevelt was, you know, correct in the long run that the parties needed to be ideologically redefined. To have these hybrid parties wasn't useful for governing purposes anymore. Or you can say he was totally wrong about that. Now everything's too partisan, being polarized because of what he did. But I don't get what.
By the way, it is funny. Some highly respected magazine like Newsweek or Time or some political science journal at some, you know, at some point said that the biggest problem in America today, or in American politics today, is that there's not enough polarization. That, you know, Republicans, there's not no difference between Republicans and Democrats, and so people don't understand the brand. And that what we should really try to do is make it clear that Republicans stand for this and Democrats stand for that. Obviously, we have a different problem.
I guess if we're living in, you know, 2000, maybe that would have a certain amount of logic to it, but it's hard to make that case today. But what's strange about the Trump threat is that there's not a lot of ideology to it. What is the philosophic basis of a primary challenge against the Freedom Caucus? It's really just it is more revenge. They're in my way. Please rally to my side and get people who are out of and get them out of my way. And you know, as much as Trump is referred to as sort of the great persuader, and that he did take stances that were ideologically not in sync with traditional conservatism, I don't think he regularly articulates what Trumpism is. You know, Bannon might. We know what Bannonism is, but Trumpism is very mushy. And even now, as much as he planted his stake on trade and being morally protectionist, he's now muddying those waters with his initial step. What he wanted for, you know, he argued he was going to be the more compassionate one in healthcare. He was the single payer guy. He's the guy that said, hey, it works in Great Britain. Now, what exactly his whole healthcare argument now was, let's get this out of the way so I can get the taxes. So there's no sense of what he actually wanted to see in healthcare reform. So if he's going to pick a fight with his own party, what's it even about?
Yeah. No, it's a good point, and I think it would be a mistake. I think he should work the charm offensive more, and so I think that these tweets where he's attacking Justin Amash and Raul Labrador and Mark Meadows by name is counterproductive. That would be, if I were advising him, it would be the charm offensive. Let's get to know these people and let's work with them. And not just the Freedom Caucus either. I mean, obviously it doesn't do you any good if you pick up Freedom Caucus votes and lose, you know, moderate, establishment Republican votes. But he needs to have a better relationship and a better rapport with these guys. That's the direction that I would work on. And, try to get something on the scoreboard.
Now, as complicated as domestic policy has become, foreign policy is getting complicated real fast. You had the chemical weapons attack in Syria, where you had this odd dual message out of the White House, sort of one, hey, America first, who cares? And two,
I was
it's all Obama's
by
fault.
This. Well, not to say the Obama's fault thing, but I was very confused. I was led to believe that Obama cut a deal with Putin and that Russia was going to had already gotten rid of all the chemical weapons in Syria. Wasn't that the deal that we reached years ago?
That was what came out of when there was a chemical weapons attack and Obama was on the verge of a military strike and the British Parliament rejected joining that endeavor. Obama said, I'm going to take this to Congress now, seeing that there's concern that this doesn't have public backing. And then John Kerry opened the door to a deal on those lines with the Russians and seized upon. And we do know that a lot of chemical weapons were accounted for, and there weren't a lot of chemical weapons tax for several years. Obviously, they're not all gone, and how they're being used today. But Trump has to decide what is the philosophy here. Is it because Obama's weakness is happening and therefore we don't want this to happen? Or is it, I don't care if it happens because it's not my problem? If your position is, I don't care if it happens, not my problem, American first, well, that is the posture that permits other countries to do it with mm-hmm. want and abandon. So you can't call Obama weak and say you're strong because you are giving them the incentive to do it right now. I mean, I mean, own your own position, own your own ideology. So that's going on right now. You have,
and of course, I mean, well, and I think the bottom, you know, the fundamental problem here, of course, is the sort of Vietnam syndrome that we have that's still in the wake of the Iraq War. I think, well, and Libya, and other examples, but I think that we are now afraid of intervention, and there's a sense that intervention, for humanitarian purposes specifically, will lead to even worse outcomes. So a power vacuum where ISIS can move in, things like that. So, you know, as much as I, you know, will blame Barack Obama for ironically empowering Russia and Vladimir Putin in many, many ways that transcend anything Donald Trump has ever done to help Russia. It also goes back to George W. Bush. I mean, if it hadn't been for the Iraq invasion, then we might have been in a much better position to take action on some of these other things. Like maybe we would have gotten Assad out 5 years ago instead of what happened. So I do think that we were chastened, and that there is no stomach in America. Like, let's say that Donald Trump did own his foreign policy and said, this aggression will not stand, man, and we're going to go do something. Unless he totally acted unilaterally, I mean, I just don't think that there would be any congressional buy-in, even among his own party, to do any sort of regime change or whatever.
And he ran that way. I mean, Trump ran, I wouldn't say as an isolationist, I'd say as a nationalist, but basically said, we shouldn't be getting involved in foreign entanglements, particularly when the primary rationale is humanitarian. I mean, he's all for bombing the blank out of people when it's on nationalist ground. So let's go bomb ISIS. Let's he's even seen any saber-eyeing with North Korea right now. But when it comes to things that are trying to stop genocide somewhere else, he has explicitly said, not my problem.
But in fairness, I mean, that sounds very callous.
It's a definition of callous.
No, but there is, I mean, but I do think there's an argument that when you go in, like Saddam Hussein was a horrible, brutal murderer. His sons were raping and pillaging in Iraq. But we can make a really good argument that most Iraqis would be better off if we hadn't toppled that regime. You know what I'm saying?
Well,
or Muammar Gaddafi. I mean, my point is, it sounds really incredibly callous and uncompassionate to say, like, it's horrible what's happening in Syria, but as president, it's not really my problem. But there is a somewhat defensible argument for not intervening, which is to say things could get even worse.
And then this is why Obama, I mean, the point is that there's more than two choices than intervene or not intervene. And look, you know, what Obama did in Syria didn't work out as intended. I'm not defending that. But
this is where I think, and I'm not saying this is true, but, you know, the argument that we can blame Obama holds a little bit of water, because you could make an argument that there was a time when we could have supported rebels in Syria who might have overthrown Assad.
Might have.
I don't know. Frankly,
you can't know.
No, I'll be honest with you. I'm skeptical that they wouldn't have been worse. But you could argue that.
Sure.
And then you could argue. But then I think you could argue it's too late now.
Right.
That ship has sailed.
But
and so we don't have Trump. It doesn't have the opportunity that Obama might have had.
Might. I mean, nothing can be proven definitively in this question.
And I'm skeptical,
but
I'll be honest.
Almost no American wanted Obama to military strike in Syria. And so Obama said, while I don't want to get us involved in the military quagmire, I still care. I don't want to turn away from a genocide. Are there things I can do diplomatically with some? I mean, there was some support for rebels in there. So can I do some limited military involvement with diplomatic pressure, working with Russia? We work with Russia on Iran. We work with Russia on Libya. It's not like we've never done it before. Let's see if we can find some common ground here. Obviously, didn't pan out, but I wouldn't say it was a policy based on callousness. He was trying to solve the problem. Trump right now is saying, at the same time, I don't think it even is a problem because it's not our problem, and it's Obama's fault.
Has he said that? Has he said anything about this? Well, I don't even. Think
I mean, what he said yesterday. Wait, I mean, in the campaign, he said explicitly.
Oh yeah.
You know, if Assad's in there, I don't care. I just want to stop ISIS. Yesterday, he said, you know, not directly about Syria. I don't want to be president of the world. I want to be president of the United States, America first. He reiterated that on the day when everyone's freaking out about.
And didn't somebody say a couple weeks ago, somebody from the administration said a couple weeks ago that, you know, it's up to the Syrian people if they want to get rid of Assad?
I think Tillerson said that.
Okay. So, I mean, that's, you know, that's not good. I mean, that's not good when a couple weeks later this.
It is the inevitable result of that attitude. If you're going to say, essentially, not my problem, you're going to see more of that sort of thing. I mean, obviously, it's not a guarantee you're not going to see it because bad things happen under Obama's watch too. But it clearly seems far less restrained now once you go deeper down that path. And maybe because Americans in their heart of hearts don't care either that there's no political consequence to it, but it certainly raises the possibility that the world is going to look more chaotic, more fractious, more deadly, you know, by 2020 than it did in 2016.
Yeah, no, it's just obviously it's a horrible situation, and I think it's really this weird thing where Americans are going to be watching these horrific images on TV. And there's going to be a desire to do something. I feel like the public is so, the American public are fickle. And so they see these horrible images on TV and then they say, we need to go do something. And then you go do something and they're like, why are you doing that? It's none of our business, you know? And so they don't have a stomach to watch. The American public doesn't have the stomach to watch on TV these atrocities. But then if we intervene and things go wrong and things happen as they always do, they don't have the stomach to stick it out.
Well, look, but so you can go back to the sinking of the Lusitania, which has been characterized as, you know, the 9/11 of the early 20th century. I mean, Americans were horrified, but still the impulse of Americans at that moment was not, I don't want to be in a war with Germany. They still did not, they still want to maintain a sense of protection from the fractiousness of Europe, which proved, you know, untenable at the end. So it's not unusual for Americans to be saddened.
But of course, the Lusitania, the saber rattling was done by tabloids, right? To help stir up interest
that was
in
more
going to war.
That was Spanish American War.
No, I stand corrected, Mister. All right. Okay, then, but anyway, here's my larger point about Syria is, you know, there was a time when we wouldn't have known, the average person wouldn't have known or cared that much about horrible things happening because you wouldn't have seen them on TV. You wouldn't have seen the images, certainly not every day or 24 hours a day. And so I do think that our media age has changed. They've made us, in both cases, I think I think that the images that we see when disasters and atrocities happen make us more compassionate and more wanting to intervene. And in many ways, that's a good thing. But then I also think that the coverage or the media coverage of war also makes us less likely to stick with things when they go bad. this isn't original to me, but if the media had covered World War II, you know, and some of the bad things that went wrong, and, you know, some of our wars where tens of thousands of people, you know, were killed, which in terms of casualties makes, say, Iraq look pretty small.
Yeah.
Again, with the caveat, every life is precious. I just wonder if you look back at, say, World War II and the years of fighting, and, you know, I don't know how many Russians, for example, died. I mean, that it's just unbelievable that the numbers of Russians who died alone in World War II. If we would have the stomach to stick it out and win that war with the media covering and images of our soldiers coming home in body bags.
I mean, because these issues are so vexing and horrific, that isolationist streak of the country is never going to totally dissipate, and it's going to make articulating a foreign policy vision very politically fraught. I mean, so as much as I think Trump and the Republicans are learning that, you know, America first is not so simple in practice, Democrats have a lot of hard thinking to do as well. What is the foreign policy alternative to Trump's America first? Are they going to be comfortable eagerly embracing anything that explicitly endorses certain forms of intervention? I mean, Hillary did in the campaign and got a lot of backlash within the primary for it. Obama was more of an interventionist than people might have thought going into his presidency, although I think he signaled it in the 2008 campaign, but not everybody heard it. So it's the kind of thing that people like to dance around, but if those images are on your screens, you can't dance around it. So that the more chaotic the world gets by 2020, the more imperative it is for Democrats to say, here's how we do things differently.
Yeah, and I think we would both agree that Trump doesn't want any part of this, and he has no interest in this, and that this will, you know, unless something else happens, I think he's just going
to
try.
I don't know what he wants to do with North Korea. And I know when I talk to people on the left, I feel really nervous that he's going to bomb North Korea. And he might.
Really?
Oh, yeah. I mean,
do tell. This is a foreign concept. I mean, obviously, they're being provocative. They're testing, you know, weapons and. But
Trump talked about bombing North Korea in 2000 in his book. And he sort of talks about North Korea's provocations far differently than he talks about Russia's or Syria's. So even Iran, I mean, he has been very quiet about Iran since he got into office. There's no talk about undoing the nuclear deal. But if there's one country has been the most provocative towards, it's North Korea. And North Korea is being provocative in return.
Right.
So if there was one place where I would be most nervous about it, I think a lot of folks on the left are nervous about it, it's there. But I don't know if you saw the statement that Tillerson made yesterday, where he just sort of, we've talked about North Korea enough and we're not going to comment about it. You could interpret that two different ways. It could mean, I'm going to drop a bomb tomorrow because I'm done talking, or I'm going to sound like I'm talking tough, I'm not really going to do anything, which is like most things that Trump does. So I don't really know. I think there's a mystery there, what he actually wants to do there.
Yeah. Wow. That's an interesting one.
I didn't mean to scare you.
What does North Korea do? What does China do?
And he's meeting with China this weekend at Mar-a-Lago. Where North Korea is going to be one of the issues on the table. I mean, that's always been the big challenge. How do you get China's North Korea's closest ally? How do you get them to cooperate with constraining their nuclear ambitions? And there's been some pieces about how China is terrified how this meeting is going to go, because they care a lot about formality and protocol, which Trump does not do, that the Chinese president is not a real chummy, backslapping sort of guy. And there's all sorts of ways that this could be just a, you know, diplomatic disaster. And that you may say, who cares? Trump wants to show that he wants to snub China. But he certainly probably wants China's help when it comes to North Korea. And if that becomes a disaster of a meeting, you know, how much does that make North Korea spiral out of control?
Yeah. All right. I got to run to the airport and a few. Anything else we need to talk about or plug?
You had a piece in Daily Beast this week, right?
Yes, I did. What was it about, Bill? I'm blanking on
the right wing trolls.
That's right.
Alt right trolls.
Yeah. Coincidence that they all went away after the election? Is this Twitter purging the alt right, or was it as I now suspect that at least some of the people who were trolling me and a lot of other people were actually Russian and Russian bots?
Does this mean the alt right is a mirage?
I think it inflated their numbers. I think it made them look a lot bigger and a lot more powerful. Remember, they only had 300 people who showed up at the at their big Washington D.C. rally, and that guy Richard Spencer gave a speech at Texas A&M where there were like three people who showed up, and then like 20 reporters, you know. So I think that this inflated their numbers, and of course the goal of Russia, you know, is partly to sow chaos and discontent and animosity and division. Aside from helping elect Donald Trump, trying to. They also wanted to do that. And I think they did it very smart the way that they did it. And of course, you know, Marco Rubio now claims that, or now says that his campaign team was hacked. There's even some suggestion that these trolls were operating, helping Bernie Sanders against Hillary Clinton. So, check out that piece at the Daily Beast.
All right. And check out my podcast, This Is Not Normal, at liberaloasis.com. And I'll have something in Real Clear Politics on Monday, but I don't know what it is yet. And I'll talk to you next week as well.
All right. Check us out on Twitter at DMZ Show. And we'll see you all back here in the DMZ next week.
All right.
Thanks, Bill.
Take care.
Yeah.
Thanks for listening to Blogging Heads TV. You can help support this content by remembering to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. You can subscribe to all Blogging Heads episodes or to a specific program by going to our subscribe page at bloggingheads.tv/subscribe. There you can sign up for podcast downloads via iTunes or Stitcher, or you can subscribe to our email and we'll send you an alert every time we post a new episode.